Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Happy Tuesday and welcome to today's edition of Global Leader Radio. The purpose of our show is to engage in conversations that highlight our guests, educate our learning community, and add value to all who seek to optimize their leadership acumen. We achieve this purpose by providing our learning community with key takeaways, including resources and advice that have led to the personal and professional success of our guests. And we've got a good one today. And today's topic is centered on leadership in every field of life, from the cotton field to the football field to the business field. And with that overview, we welcome today's guest, Dr. Joseph Proffitt. Dr. Proffitt is founder, president, and CEO of Multimedia Digital Broadcast Corporation, and he's also the founder of Inc. Magazine. He was born the son of a poor sharecropper and went on to attend and graduate from a college in the Deep South during a period of great racial unrest in this country. He was drafted in the first round of the 1971 NFL draft by the Atlanta Falcons, and then after retiring from football due to injuries, he went on to become a very successful businessman. So from a business perspective, he became CEO of a $100 million company, an advisor to the president, both Reagan and Bush, a philanthropist, and an author. He has served on many commissions, advisory committees, and boards at the federal level, along with several other political and philanthropic organizations. He's also owned a Burger King store and was the first black owner of an international house of pancakes. So in his sports career, Dr. Proffitt was inducted into the Business and Professional Hall of Fame in 1994 and the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame in 1999. Dr. Proffitt has received numerous awards, also been featured in USA Today and the Money section in the Wall Street Journal. He served his country by accepting an appointment to president by President Ronald Reagan, then a reappointment by President George Bush to serve on the International Trade Commission. Additionally, he has dedicated the majority of his professional career as chairman and CEO of Youth United for Prosperity, or YUP. He's also the president and CEO of the NFL Alumni Atlanta chapter. Dr. Proffitt holds a bachelor's degree in education from the University of Louisiana in Monroe and a doctor of philosophy from Haywood University. And Dr. Joseph Proffitt, it is indeed an honor to welcome you to Global Leader Radio today, sir. How are you?
Smiles, I am great. Happy to be here. Great day in Atlanta. Couldn't ask for a better day. Sun is shining and everything is lovely.
Yeah, it is a gorgeous day. I think Kurt Mellish said it would be a 10 on a Mellish meter today.
Absolutely.
It's always good.
Absolutely.
So to begin with, please tell us a little bit about Dr. Joseph Proffitt, starting with your original birthplace, home, and a bit about your work experience and take us up to the present.
Well, you know, it's amazing. I was just listening to some of the accolades that you were mentioning during my introduction. I recall back when I was growing up in Louisiana, my third grade teacher said that I would never amount to anything other than the son of a sharecropper.
Wow.
It's amazing how things sometimes change when the spirit is with you.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about home is Monroe?
Monroe, Louisiana. Monroe is what they call in the Arkla Miss. It's in the northeast corner of the state of Louisiana, and it borders Arkansas and Mississippi on the east, and Arkansas and Texas on the west. So we have the Arkla Miss and the Arkla Tech.
Very good. So tell us a little bit about kind of where you came up from. I know the book that you have called Fields of Success, and it is available to those folks on Amazon.com as well as several other outlets, correct?
Yes, it's available, of course, on Amazon, and also it's available at joeproffitt.com, where the book is available, and also our kids' charity benefits from the sale of that book if they go to joeproffitt.com.
It's perfect, and the name of the book is Fields of Success, Raised Expectations, and we're going to talk a little bit more about those raised expectations as we move along. But interestingly enough, I remember, as I said in the open, you're going to take us from the cotton fields to the football field and then to the business field and the boardrooms, et cetera. So yes. Tell us a little bit about that cotton field side.
Well, actually, growing up in the 60s in Louisiana, in a town that just recently News magazine named the poorest town in America.
Wow.
Lake Providence, East Carroll Parish.
Wow.
We're back in the 60s. The only thing that a person like me, being of what we would call then colored, colored folks could basically work in the fields. There were some educators, school teachers, et cetera. But primarily for common folk, we had to work in the field, and we're very fortunate to have a job.
Right.
And the book starts there. That's where I learned my work ethic. In those days, we were getting, I can't recall the exact amount, but something like $4 a day.
Hmm.
But my dad, it was nine of us. I was the middle child,
okay.
Four brothers, four sisters. And we learned how to work and honor and work. So the cotton fields were then was a means for survival for us. It allowed us to get off that plantation and to move to from Lake Providence over to Monroe. My dad, of course, served in the military, like most folks during his time, during the Second World War.
Okay.
And had to come home to a segregated South. But you know what? My dad's attitude was so positive, it was contagious.
Uh-huh.
And the book is about my own story, starting in the field. And from there, my dad always said that the way out of poverty is through education. Now, he didn't confuse education with intelligence, mm-hmm. because you had to be intelligent just to survive the system.
That's right.
But education was denied to most of my people in the South during the 50s and 60s. But the work ethic was something that we were blessed with. And from that, I took that same spirit of accomplishments in the cotton field to the football field. Oh. I can remember being in the fields on Saturday morning listening to LSU Tigers and Billy Cannon and guys that I just imagine just being able to be on a football team. But even then, I never I dreamed that I could be on a football team like LSU. But it was so far out of reach that from a child standpoint, that was just about an impossible dream. But I still dreamt it.
Well, good, because I definitely want to touch base on the football field going forward. But so tell me a little bit about the inspiration for your book.
Well, the book, the inspiration came from my own story. When we were growing up, I remember in Louisiana and going back and forth, we moved from Lake Providence over to Monroe when I was about, I guess, 8-9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then every summer we'd go back over there to work. That's how we helped support my dad. So my inspiration came from my desire to help my dad to get off that plantation. And everything I did, everything I thought about doing was to try and be a very intricate part of earning money so that we could help. Now, I didn't know that $4 a day. Oh, by the way, I picked my first 100 pounds of cotton when I was 11 years old.
Wow.
And for those of you that are listening, that you or maybe your granddad or someone may have been in the cotton fields, but it's very difficult to pick 100 pounds.
No doubt about it. And you did that in how quick a time period?
Well, it took me all day, but I worked my way up.
In one day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I worked my way up to it and was able to, in order to get, for those of you that may be familiar with the process, you'd have to start very early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And work late at night, and was able to carry what we call two rolls.
Wow, that is truly impressive. So tell me a little bit about the relationship with your father. How did he help to mold the man you are today?
My dad, as I say, was the military, and he had a process of getting things done. I'll give you an example. One day I asked Dad, I said, Dad, why are you working for these people, and you've been to the military. You've been all over the world, and you come back here to Lake Providence. And my dad said, well, I got a wife, a dog, and all you kids to feed. And he said, I'm going to do what I have to do until I can do better. So I was inspired by that, and doing do what you can when you can, as long as you can. And when it was time, when my dad finally got enough money saved to move his family from that farm, he did it. So my whole upbringing was about trying to not only get the best education that I could, but when I got to the sports, when coach said run one extra sprint, I run five.
Okay.
One for him, five for me. And when Dad said we need 50 pounds of cotton from everybody that's able to pick, I wanted to get more than 50. So it inspired me, his regard for the law, although he knew that we were living under a what he called a broke system, the entire system
exactly
was against people of color. And he always told us, though, he said, the only thing that separates you is money. Hmm. He said, now, if you got the money, you don't have to sharecrop. Because there were black owners, very few, but there were some black owners of farms that had land.
Right, had their own.
They had their own land, of course. And so we always was inspired and had expectations that, hey, you are going to be the one to make a difference. That's why I believe to this day the power of one.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful relationship. So how old was he when he passed?
My dad was a young man. He worked every day. He never, that I can remember, took a vacation.
So this is Monday through Sunday? I mean, Sunday through Sunday?
No, it was Monday through Saturday.
Okay.
And you worked all day. I mean, from the sun up to sundown. Sunday, you couldn't go. You had to rest.
Okay.
And so he would rest on Sunday. We'd go to church every Sunday. Mama had us in church, my grandmother. But he had to have that day just to rest. He never took a day off. And I always said if I ever had an opportunity, I was going to get my dad, once he moved back to Monroe and was able, he was a foreman on, he was a contractor, he was a finisher and concrete layer. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get my dad on a vacation. So my whole goal throughout college was to get out, make enough money to help my dad and get him on a vacation. My dad passed away my senior year in college.
Wow.
And it took me a long time to get over that because my prayer was that he would live long enough for me to be able to help him.
Right.
And didn't happen.
Right.
So he was 50 years old when he died.
50 years old.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, very good. So I know you mentioned intelligence was, he felt like intelligence was something that you didn't have to get from a book.
Couldn't get it from a book.
Couldn't get it from a book. So intelligence has a measure of common sense.
Yes, common sense. And my dad would always say that you can't teach intelligence. Hmm. He said, now you can learn, you can teach a person, you can educate them, but you can't teach intelligence. And during those days, a person like me of color, a dark complexion, had a harder road to hoe, as they would say, because we were told for decades and not centuries, if not centuries, that if you were dark, you were different.
Okay.
Well, my dad turned that around and said, yeah, you're dark, you're different, you're better.
and he different always, can be better.
He said, it could be better. He said, you're not better than anybody else, but you're no less than anybody else. So I grew up with that conviction, and I took that even to sports, that I figured it would take more than one guy to bring me down if I was worth anything, because anybody could bring down one guy.
One-on-one.
One-on-one, yeah.
So I read that there's actually, when I looked through the book, and I have a copy here for those of you who are not able to see it, obviously, 271 pages in this fantastic book, and it's a fantastic read, by the way. I spent a lot of time reading this, and it's so personal that it's very difficult to put down at some points, and we'll touch on that too. But what three lessons or truths will your readers find in the pages of this book?
Well, one, that you have to set a high bar in whatever you're doing in life. The subject of the book is fields of success. Success doesn't come in just monetary. Success has many different faces and different phases of life. So you set a high bar for yourself. And then you have to have a purpose for success. Success is something that's earned. It's not given to anyone. It's not found. It's earned. And on whatever level of success that you find yourself earning, that is the best way to achieve it. Then to keep your priorities high, you must be able to keep them straight and keep them high. And if you set those priorities, I have a mantra. It's called professional results and daily effort. I grew up with the idea always saying, have pride, have pride. And I said, well, what can I develop to remind me that every day? And I came up with the acronym PRIDE, Professional Results and Daily Efforts. And it helps me in everything that I'm doing. So when you're looking at achieving success, whether it's with your family, in your job, in your church, your community, success is something that we're all thriving for. And if we are conscious enough, we achieve it.
So I'm also finding this book, again, as I said, a fascinating read on many, many different levels. So from the perspective of you, the writer, it is a very personal book as it came through the pages of this book. And it looked to me as though about a third, maybe even little bit more than a third of the book was dedicated to the cotton fields piece of it, where you got the basic foundation and the whole framework for who the man is today was built back then. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct. Most of my, like I said, my work ethic was built. That foundation was built back early when I was young. I understood the difference between hard work and getting money for it. There was a big difference. Everyone should get the maximum amount they can for their work. But work is honor. Mm. My dad would always say, if they forget my name, just remember this. I'm a prophet with honor. Mm. And when I came to Atlanta, they were saying, Joe who? I said, I'm Joe the prophet with honor.
And just so everybody knows, prophet is spelled P-R-O-F-I-T.
Yes, sir.
And you had a great saying for that, too, right? Just like what you expect to make in business?
Yes, sir. My dad said when I left, when I was drafted by the Falcons, he said, now, son, he said, now, when you go to Atlanta, do me proud. And I said, well, Dad, I thought I was already doing it. He said, yeah, son. He said, but I want you to keep me proud. And I said, well, Dad, how would I do that? He said, now, you're leaving Joe Prophet. Don't come back Joe Broke.
Yeah, that's pretty important.
It's very important. It guided me throughout my professional career. You'll also see in the book that I have a chapter in there about the NFL players. I'm sure you'll probably get to that part about how a lot of us find ourselves in a category of being just that, broke after 3 years out of the game. And it doesn't matter what level we come in on. Having been a number one draft choice myself, I've seen other number ones in 3 years after the game broke.
Blow through the money.
Blow through it.
Oh, I've gotten to that part. As a matter of fact, it was pretty interesting, but I want to put a pushpin in that, and I want to come back and just get a feel for what you thought and what you found particularly enjoyable about crafting the book. Because I know when you have to pour your heart and soul into your own story, it brings you back to a lot of different places. Some places you didn't want to go, and some places obviously you felt like you needed to make the story really stick together.
You know, it's amazing you said that. It took me 7 years to write this book, because there were chapters that I was writing that I had to put it down because it brought back memories as if some of these events were happening as I was writing them. And they brought back powerful memory. One in particular, when I lost my dad, was one of the chapters. And then some of the other items in that book that I covered were very personal, and I had to put it down. So what's gratifying to me was that I just spoke with one of the guys that was in college with me that read the book. He called me. He was the president of the Student Association,
okay,
which was an all-white organization then. And he told me, it's on Facebook, by the way, he said, Joe, I remember, he was the one that created Joe Prophet Day. It was unheard of in 1967 through 71. And he said, it was the first time I had gone to a black funeral with your dad. And when he said that, it just brought back memories. And I went like, yeah, he said, I had never imagined your funerals were just like ours.
Wow.
Yeah. He said, we were in a situation that we all learned from each other. So it was quite painful. And most of the chapters that I was writing about that brought back memories.
Mm, very good. What are a couple of your learnings from your beginnings in the cotton fields that would perhaps be important for our learning community to grasp? I know you talked about the work ethic as one of the things, but I'm sure that there's probably a couple more, many more, certainly in the book. I know that there's more, but I want to hear them in your words.
Well, one of the things that we can learn other than just the work ethic from is that we all have inherent differences, but we have more things in common than we don't. And if we are able to understand each other, let me give an example. Doing desegregation is what I didn't call it integration. It was desegregation. We wanted to have the same opportunities that everybody else had. We didn't have to be in the same room, in the same class, in the same, but we wanted to have the same amenities. We wanted to have the same respect as other folk. When my dad went to the war, he lost a lot of his friends. The enemy didn't care whether they were black or white or Hispanic.
That's right.
They were Americans, and they were fighting to kill us. And when I think about all those things that make me who I am. And I always try to say, even during desegregation, both sides thought they were right.
Hmm.
And what happened was, this: if everybody's right, then nobody's wrong. But it turned out that the Lord had a plan and still does for this nation. And we had challenges. We met them.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have challenges, and we will continue to meet them. So if I learned anything else growing up other than just the work ethic, it's how to work together, how people are the same. And if you look at African, they say go back to Africa. Well, the first person that died in the American Revolution looked like me, according to history. So you've got to figure who is in charge of what. What does it matter? Because when you go into a situation where you need medical attention, for instance,
mm-hmm.
they don't care if it's black blood or white blood. It's type A
right.
and type B.
That's all they care about.
And that's all they care about. And that's the important thing. So if I can work with my kids in my youth program to teach them how to work with each other and understand their differences, and those of you that are listening to the broadcast about Christians, and I hope a lot of them out there, our father had many, many children. He had, I think there was 12 tribes, mm-hmm. original from
Israel.
Yes. And those tribes all looked different. But they had one thing in common. They had one father. And Abraham goes back to the beginning of that. So if we understand each other and who we are, all other stuff is minor. It's sideline stuff.
That is a great point and a great thought as well. So we're talking to Dr. Joseph Prophet. He's the founder, president, and CEO of Multimedia Digital Broadcast Corporation, and he's also the founder of Inc. Magazine. He's written a book called Fields of Success, Raised Expectations. He's also a former NFL player and still connected with the NFL, and he's a breakaway success in the business world. And before we go any further, just want to make sure you know that this particular episode of Global Leader Radio is being sponsored by Quest 35 Housing. And their mission is to develop and implement affordable, supportive housing programs that serve the special needs homeless and or low-income populations. Quest Village III is going up now, and it will be home to previously chronically homeless men, women, and veterans. So when you get a moment, you can check their logo on the Global Leader Radio website. So at this point, I'll ask you a couple of questions as we transition from the cotton fields over to the football field,
okay.
as we shift our focus. So is it true that you greatly admired Gail Sayers and that you wore number 40 in honor of him?
Yes, sir. Back in the 60s when we were growing up, of course, there were very few people of color that we could admire. What I admired about Gale Sayers, first of all, he was a great athlete. And he had a charisma about him that stood out from any other folk, not just black players, but all players. And so I had to pattern myself. My most favorite football player, of course, was Jim Brown.
Jim Brown.
I mean, but Gail Sayers was more of my – Jim Brown was a bruiser like my big brother. Gail Sayers had more finesse, and he was a little bit faster. So I was more like my like Gail Sayers. So when I went to college, and there's a whole story about that, how I had to walk on. That's one of the things there that I would hope give kids inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
I walked on to that campus – did not have a scholarship,
that
walked
was a great
away
story.
From a scholarship. And the Lord blessed me to not only get the scholarship, and after 3 days of trying to get a uniform and telling me that, I was on my own and they didn't want me out there, to go from that to retiring to Jersey 4 years later and having a special day was nothing but the grace of God. And during that time, I had to have a beacon of hope. The late Ronald Reagan talked about, that shining place on the hill. Well, to me, my shining place was an individual named Gale Sayers. He had number 40. So, because in high school, I was number 23.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went there, the Spirit led me, asked for number 40. So they gave it to me.
Wow.
They gave me number 40. And I was, every day, I had Gale Sayers picture in my locker, and I had the Serenity Prayer in my locker. And it said, the Serenity Prayer really guided me in a lot of dark days where I needed somebody to just to give me hope and to keep that shining light going in my spirit. And my mother would always say, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine.
Yeah.
And Gail Sayers had a big light that shined on me. And when they retired my jersey, I called Gail. I said, hey, man, they retired our jersey.
So what was it like to finally meet him?
Oh, it was great. It was. I met him the first time was at a golf tournament. And I told him a story. And he went like, Joe, he said, you know, you're the number one. Don't talk to another number one like that. Don't tell him. I said, Gail, I was just named the number one draft choice by the way I was drafted. I said, but I've always been a Gail Sayers supporter. Right. And I've always admired what you have done. And when you did, and I'm quoting now, when I told him, I said, when you did Brian's song, that was
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's right.
I said, then I knew that the success could be transcended from the football field into other fields. And that gave me some hope even beyond football. And then when I got injured, I thought about you again. And he went like, well, this is fantastic. So Gail and I have formed a relationship that I think is unbreakable. Hmm. And what if I can be to any athlete, any non-athlete, any kid, that I could do something to give them that type of hope or something to admire, I would love to be able to have done that. And when I go to that big football field in the sky, the Lord said, Joe, what do you did? I said, well, I helped inspire some people. I helped some kids to have a better life.
Amen. Amen. So you devoted a lot of your professional career as chairman and CEO of Youth United for Prosperity. Tell us a little bit about that.
In 1995, I was on the turnpike up in Jersey and gone over to Norwalk, Connecticut to a company I had just bought, International Microwave Corporation. And I was moving it from Stanford over to Norwalk, Connecticut. And I was riding with an attorney, and he was talking about all the problems that we were having with black youth. I mean, just gangs and kids getting together and just goofing off. And it just came to me, and I said, well, why don't we get something that will make kids come together for something other than goofing off? And it just came to me, Youth United for Prosperity. And because I remember that reading I was growing up that the Lord wanted all of us to prosper. He said, go forth and prosper. So I put that together, and I came up with Youth United for Prosperity that then spawned the acronym YUP. There were a lot of yuppies going on
at the time.
Mm-hmm. So and the YUP, Youth United for Prosperity, stuck.
Interesting. So what's the most surprising thing about going from being a college athlete to being a professional athlete?
The biggest surprise was that I learned very quickly that professional football was a business, not a lifestyle. And in college, you got a lifestyle. You know, you get $10 a month on scholarship, and you're doing this. But professional sports is a business. And those of us that understood that early fared better than the ones that got it later. And some of us never get it. But it's a big difference in doing something for a living and doing it for an education. Because my main purpose in college was to get out of school, was to graduate, and to do it in 4 years. That was very important to me. I ran track in the spring, and I played football. Mm-hmm. And my dad always said, he said, I don't care what you play on, but you better get your lessons. So I learned very well from my dad's desire, and he never had an opportunity to get an education, because my dad grew up, he didn't have an option. You had to work and just to stay alive and survive. So I tell folks all the time, I am not a victim. Mm-hmm. I'm not. My grandparents were victims of a system that denied them equal opportunity and equal protection under the law. They were victims. Mm-hmm. But their prayers, I think I'm an answer to one of their prayers, that if, as Dr. King said, not liking myself to Dr. King, but he said, I may not get there with you, but as a people, I will. And that's the same prayer I think we all have, whether we're black or white, our kids and grandkids. We may not get to that paradigm, but our kids and our grandkids will, and in the spirit, if nothing else.
That's a great point. So in your opinion, which of the two was most challenging? To become an NFL player or having success in the world of business?
Oh, the latter.
The latter, okay.
Yeah, the world of business. Those of us that are athletes, and it doesn't, you can be a tennis player, you can be basketball, whatever sport you, golf, a lot of athletes, even cheerleaders are considered athletes. They have to do. But the business world is a different paradigm. It, you have to prepare yourself, what I call, and I got this new deal I'm working on now called the transition playbook. Mm-hmm. And the playbook, the transition playbook prepares us to transcend from one career to another. And that same attitude will get us from one career to another career. But for me, it was just from football, which was my career, to business. And there are principles. But one thing that I've noticed about football and sports that business now is starting to realize, training camp. No matter how well you perform in professional sports, every year you're going to have a training camp. You're going to go back and freshen up on your skills.
Fundamentals.
Fundamentals. All your fundamental skills, all the things you do to make you better. Well, what we're doing in my instance was to make sure that that transition playbook was applied with steps and procedures and to provide something we always had and still have as athletes, a coach. So I trained myself as being one of those coaches that will help in the business arena, same way coaches help me in the athletic arena.
Oh, very good. So how do you do that? Can you kind of walk us through that piece of it? I know you perhaps maybe even in the process of putting something together in terms of a business.
Yes, sir. Well, first of all, you must be able to see yourself as helping and building. Business is building something, whether it's building a small business or a large business or medium business, you're building something. There are a lot of ego involved in building things. And entrepreneurship is, I think, something you can get it two ways. You can be born with it or it can be learned. And if you're an entrepreneur, what we call the entrepreneur spirit, it means that sometimes you don't even know you have it. You may work 30 years for a company. And then all of a sudden you find yourself out in the cold for whatever reason. Then you got to survive. Then you go out and you start your own business. And you go like, hey, I didn't know I could do this. We don't know what we don't know. And sometimes we're challenged with the unknown. And when that happens, sometimes miracles are performed. So you prepare yourself for a business by, first of all, having that desire to do it and then learning the rules of the game. It's like any other game, sports, business, and the ultimate game, life.
Life.
If you learn the rules, then you can play the game.
So what would be in that transition playbook, perhaps, at a high level?
Now, that's a secret. If I tell you
okay,
I have to
all right. Okay. I'll move on to the next one.
Now, that's going to be available in the what we call in our success kit. That's going to be available for folks. And those that can't afford it, we'll probably give it to them.
I love it.
But it will be available.
I love it. So when did you start your first business? And can you tell us about your early entrepreneurial experiences? Because you've had quite a few successes.
Yes, sir. I noticed when you came on, you said I had a Burger King. Actually, I was a multi-unit operator for Burger King.
Wow.
And I started breakfast here in Atlanta for Burger King. I had the two largest volumes in the whole system for Burger King. I made the first $1 million year with Burger King at my downtown store that went on to be the leader in the whole region in Burger King. We started breakfast in my downtown store. That particular store, those of you that are out there, if you recall, it was right at Central Park. We had three dining rooms, an elevator. That we had a showplace for Burger King Corporation. Had that business. Then I opened one up at the old Playboy Club called Jilly's, the place for ribs. And it had the best ribs. They called Fall Off the Bone Good. And then from there, I started. Then I had Profit Interiors. At one time, I had seven different businesses.
At one time?
At one time. I had a liquor store out on Boulder Crest Baller Shop. That was $1 million store. So I was quite busy in the early, early days. And then, of course, you know, I started Communications International, the $100 million company that we grew from the basement of that Jilly's restaurant in downtown at the Playboy Club.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Impressive.
Yes, sir.
So I also understand that you've worked internationally, most notably in the United Arab Emirates. So was this your first international experience?
Actually, for business, yes.
Okay.
I had been in Riyadh in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We had done a tenor out there, and we bid at that job. ATT can't muscle us out. We had to bid it again, and the third time was the charm. We won it. But I was in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia before the war started in Kuwait. Mm. So when the war started, Kuwait, we just moved down about 300 miles down to Kuwait City. And I was there for, I don't know, maybe 8 months. And then in the United Arab Emirates, I was in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Jabal Ali, in about a 3 to 4 month period. I was in Bahrain. I met the emir.
My goodness.
I was amazed with the emir. The emir looked just like me. He looked like a brother from Chicago. He spoke 12 languages.
My goodness.
And you know what I kept saying, Mr. Miles? I kept saying, if those little kids in Louisiana that's been on that cotton field could see this man. I had never heard the word emir. I had heard of king and president and prime minister, but the emir? Oh, man, I was amazed, and I kept thinking, and I said, you know, if I could just show these kids what's possible and what they don't know could make all the difference in the world and give them a hope and inspiration to do better.
And that's a lot of what we do here at Global Leader Radio in a business perspective. What we try to do is we try to get leaders like you to come and sit down in that chair and spend time with us and have a conversation with you, I, and Kevin, with a few million people listening in. And you just pass along that great business advice and encouragement. And so with that respect in mind, what's the best business advice or encouragement that you've received on each of these three fields?
Well, that's a good one. The first field, the cotton field, I learned from my dad who, I mean, it's amazing how he and my mother worked together in the fields. And then after we would work, usually at dark, get home, mother could cook. She would cook the dinner. And dad would make us wash dishes. And we, my brother and I, felt like a boy's not supposed to wash dishes. And I went like, well, Daddy, you know, he said, well, son, as long as you're in my house, you're going to wash this. You're going to do everything you can to help out. So I learned teamwork. That's my first idea of how a team really works, that everybody that can pitch in. If you recall Paul in the Bible that said, if you don't work, you don't eat. Mm-hmm. Jesus said, help the poor. But if you can get up, my mama said, if everybody able to work, going to work. So I learned that was my first lesson in teamwork. And to help out and try to make a difference. The football field, the first thing I learned there was from my coach, Coach Mackie Freeze.
Mackie Freeze.
Coach Mackie Freeze had a philosophy that he would always say, perfect practice doesn't make perfect. And I'm going like, but Coach, that's all we've been taught. He said, that's wrong. And I would say, we would say, Coach, what do you mean? He said, perfect practice make perfect. He said, if you goof off in practice, if you don't perfect it in practice, you won't do it in the game. And we took that, and we used that, and for 4 years straight, we didn't lose a football game in high school.
Wow.
Richwood High School in Monroe, Louisiana, the Mighty Rams.
Look it up, folks, the Mighty Rams.
So I learned how to expect to win, and if you do everything right, you are supposed to perform, and he would say have fun, because we never associated with having fun by losing.
Okay.
So he would say, let's go out and have some fun. We know, hey, let's win this one. And we ran it for the Gipper. And one other thing I learned in football, if you're doing something right, regardless to what people may say, keep doing it the right way. I'm going to give an example. We played a team called Good Pine. Now, all you Good Pine fans out there, and maybe listen, this guy's true. We played Good Pine, I think it was probably 1966. 6-7. I can't remember, but one of those years. And the score was 106-0.
Now, this is football.
Football. And people accuse us of running score. We played everybody except the cheerleaders. we did. And listen, let me tell you this. We went in at halftime, scored something like 48-0. And my quarterback at the time was Don Zimmerman, who played with the Philadelphia Eagles. Don asked Coach Freeze, say, Coach, can we call another play this second half? Coach looked him in the eye and grabbed him by his face mask and said, you're going to run it till they stop it. So, in other words, if you're doing something good, keep doing what you're doing. Don't stop it or change it because you're tired of it. If it's working, work it. Mm-hmm. I learned that from a great coach. And he also taught us another lesson about integrity of winning. That my senior year, we lost the first game in 4 years.
Wow.
And I never forget that night. It came, we were all, I mean, everybody was crying, even the principal. She didn't even like football. The principal, she didn't even like football. She was crying that night. And I never forget this. Coach came in. The coach was a big man, big military Marine. He also had played in the major leagues baseball. He came in after the game. We had lost to Peabody down in South Louisiana. And it was a forfeit, but we
Baton
still.
Baton Rouge, right?
Yeah, right down Baton
that's
Rouge.
That's right.
And coach came in and he said, "Your boys don't have nothing to be ashamed of." He said, "You played well. You did everything you're supposed to do." He said, "But tonight, those boys deserve to win." He said, "They did not make one mistake and we made two." And he said, "You lost the game." Well, we learned later that they had an illegal player. They had, because we know those guys had mustache. We kept saying, "These boys, my goodness, in high school." Well, found out that two of them had gone to college and came back playing. But you know what? Coach demonstrated the character of this coach. He would not accept the forfeit.
Hmm.
We were undefeated if we accepted the forfeit, but he said no. He said, "That night, they beat us." I said, "But coach, they had illegal players." He said, "Doesn't matter." So what I learned then was integrity means a lot. And those kids out there, we was crying our eyes out. And he kept saying, "Sometimes in life, boys, you're going to do everything right, but you can't win that day." And that helped me in a lot of my business decisions and other things. It even helped me when I was with the Falcons, when I got injured. You know, I'm leading the league in rushing, fourth game of the season. I was out for the season. And after I stopped feeling sorry for myself, I started thinking about what else I can do.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, I got an education. I got, you know, hey, maybe I can do business. That's when I started getting the second idea. And that's when I started thinking about what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
The business side, that third piece. So now in the business side, what was perhaps advice or anything you've gotten there that have helped you succeed?
Well, one of the things that helped me succeed was the fact that my dad had a regiment. Although, I'm going to show you how things can transcend from one field to another. My dad had a regiment where he would say, "Okay, we're going to show up early before everybody else show up, and we're going to stay later than everybody else." And when, because in the sharecropping, if you didn't produce, you had to move.
Ah.
See, if you look at this movie, I think it's called A Fella and a Gentleman. Officer and a Gentleman.
Okay.
Yeah, when this guy, there's one little scene they were saying, "Because of you," this white guy was talking to, what's it, the black guy. And he
Lou Gossett?
Yeah, Lou Gossett. What's his name? Junior. Anyway, the guy, he was telling him, he said, "Because of you, we had to move every year because of people like you."
Ah.
See, yeah. So what happened in sharecropping, that's why I'm saying it was all equal. They didn't care whether you were Spanish, African American, white or Asian. If you were poor, you were in the field.
That's right.
And if you didn't produce,
you
had
to go.
So I learned then about regiments. So Dad would say, "You get there early," and everybody. And he said, "Now, when they see us coming, they say, 'Here come them damn prophets. We got to go.'" So they're like locusts. They're going to outwork you and they're going to outthink you. So in the business thing, I kept saying, they're not going to outwork me. They're not going to outthink me. And they're not going to out-inspire me. So when I would go into people and they would go like, when I started Communication International, that was prior to the breakup of AT&T.
Mm.
This was before divestiture.
Before Judge Green
decree. And I'm out trying to sell a telephone system, and people going like, "You can't buy nothing. AT&T owns everything." And I had to be persistent in letting people know, look, the new law is that you can, in fact, own your own phone. And it doesn't have to be the same color. Because, you know, in those days, AT&T say you can get any color you want. As long as it's black. And we came out with blue and all kinds of different colors. But more important on the business side was the persistence and to seek and take advice from folks that have been there. I learned early on that if you haven't been in business and made a payroll for at least 3 years, you're really not in business.
Hmm.
I mean, you're on a different level. But if you maintain a payroll for 3 years, then you're in the big leagues.
Yeah, you're officially in business.
Yes,
right?
Sir. Yes, sir.
I like that. So at the end of the day, between the cotton field, the football fields, and then into the business field, which accomplishments across the board? I don't even know if you can compare them, but if you could, what do you think would be the most profound or have the most meaning in terms of the accomplishments you've garnered?
The business field.
The business field. Okay.
Because we help so many other families.
Okay.
People are able to buy homes and able to buy cars. Mm-hmm. We grew the business over $120 million a year, and we had over 423 or 24 employees. We operated in 27 cities and 9 countries.
Wow.
And we had a lot of folks that were doing very well. So from that standpoint, it's much better to have a business that creating jobs and other opportunities. And a lot of those employees spin off, did their own business, and mm-hmm. took from what we were doing. I mean, right now there's one guy that's still in business that worked for me in my outside plant business, and now he's doing the same thing on his own. It's just a perfect situation, and it does me good to see that people are still benefiting from what we did on the business field.
Makes sense. I do want to step back for a split second and talk a little bit about that transition playbook that you mentioned. And I realize I won't ask you any questions about what's actually in that book, because I do want to live, and I don't want to. So interestingly enough, your story is such that you were drafted in the first round in 1971 by the Atlanta Falcons.
Correct.
And then the fourth game of your first professional season. Take us through the rest of the story.
Fourth game, it was about 5 minutes into the game. It was a kickoff, actually. And I was running kickoff back and had what I call a cheap shot from – we were playing the St. Louis Cardinals, and they had a guy on there that hadn't even made the team. It was after the play injury. And it was a Slocum, then called an ACL now. Mm-hmm. And it was a career-ending injury. But I had this – desire to play 5 years, and I hadn't made a deal. I had asked the Lord to allow me to do that, and when the doctors told me that my career was not only career threatening, that I would probably not even walk without a limp, was devastating. And I went to the hospital, and man, I was in pretty bad shape mentally and of course physically. Mm-hmm. But my spirit wasn't broken. And after recovering myself from the feeling sorry, I started thinking about how long my rehabilitation was going to take. And Dr. Funk, then the late, great Dr. James Funk, one of the best surgeons of his time, came in and told me that, son, it's over. You won't play anymore. And I said, well, Doc, with all due respect, I got 4 more years. And they sent in a team of psychiatrists to talk to me to convince me that it was impossible. Mm-hmm. And all I'm going to say about that is that I never gave up.
You never doubted.
Never doubted. I believed in me, and I believed in the Spirit. And I didn't believe that the Lord would have brought me through all the desegregation, the 4 years of college, and all the stuff I had gone through to let me fail the fourth game of my career.
Well, the focus I wanted to really talk about in bringing that up is the transition that you made. So somewhere along the line mentally, you transitioned from just being an athlete mm-hmm. to being an athlete who could be a businessman. Mm-hmm. And so that playbook somehow what was in your mind at that point has become the playbook today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. With proven results.
Right.
That, see, with what I always call in football, it was like those days of we're talking about, I call it the 4 years of fantasy.
Okay.
High school, you got 4 years. College, you got 4 years. So you got 4 years of fantasy and most productive part of your athletic career. Mm-hmm. High school, college. Then you get to the pros. And then you get there and you go like, hey, man, you know, I'm in the NFL. I got this thing going on. And forget that the NFL now, it's a whole different, when they say the league, it's a whole different league. It's a business. Mm-hmm. It's not a lifestyle.
Right.
And for those of us that have experience in having to make a choice, what I wanted to do was put that in my playbook and to transcend that to help other folk. But what makes it good, Mr. Miles, is that it's not just for athletes. It's for anyone that's in the throes of changing careers.
Most of us.
That's right. And sometimes that career is changed not by any choice that we make.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on age. It's based on, in like an NFL, monetary, because sometimes you make too much money.
You've got to go.
You got to go.
You become an economic liability.
There you go. And So if you had a place in your life where you're displaced for whatever reason, this transition playbook would give you we call a plays for you. We tell you what to run, when to run, how long to run it, and what to do and how to do it.
And then there might even be a coach or two to help you along the way if you need help.
Well, we call that the success the success coach kit.
Got it.
Where we get in and we have the right coaches that from various areas of disciplines, from finance to healthcare to divorce court. Did you know that 79% of all professional NFL players 5 years out of the game are divorced?
Wow.
And did you know that 83% of us 3 years after we leave the game are broke? So this transition playbook prepares athletes, entertainers, and everybody else for the next career. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I was reading an article over the weekend where I see that Allen Iverson is having a bit of problem transitioning back to quote-unquote regular life. So you see that often, I would imagine.
It's very often, and that's impossible. You can't transition back to regular life if you are Iverson, okay? First of all, you're not going to find anybody to pay you that kind of money, or you're not going to be able to generate that kind of money. So what we do in the transition playbook is to prepare you for why you're in the game. Okay, let me give an example, if I may. Say you're in a sport, an Iverson, and you're making, let's just check a number, $10 million a year. I'm not saying that's what he made. I don't know. I'm not counting anybody else's money. But say he made $10
million. I'll count it for him if he'd let me.
Say he made $10 million. Now, you have to consider, how are you going to make $10 million in anything else in life, whether you want to or not?
Highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. Now, you got a $10 million check. You are a W-2 employee. Okay? Uncle Sam going to automatically ask you for about $4.5 million of that 10.
Wow.
Maybe a little bit more. So you're not getting $10 million. You're getting maybe six. But then you spend eight because you think you got 10. Okay. So what happens to most athletes and entertainers is that those of us that are high profile have too big of egos, and we don't listen. And the only time we listen is when it's too late. When you're broke, they don't want to hear it.
That's right.
Okay. Now, what we do, and I'm part of a group that make this a reality in some of our seminars, et cetera, that, and I'm not selling here, I'm just telling you what it is. It's very important for a lot of people. As I said, even if you're not an athlete, right, if you're in between transitions between careers, this book will help.
Well, fantastic, because there are an awful lot of people who actually, you know, $10 million is relative, depends on what you do, right?
Correct.
Because there's only one Allen Iverson.
There you go.
You know, there's probably only one Kevin Finn. There might be 50 Alvin Mileses, right? And so I wouldn't be making $10 million. But the point is that it's relative, because where I am today, I would like to stay there.
There you go.
But at some point, if I don't transition mentally, if I don't transition in my thinking and my education and my intelligence, then I will be left aside like any other dinosaur.
Yes, and let me say this, if I may. If you're making $100,000 a year, okay, and you get displaced, your lifestyle is based on your salary or your income, $100,000. You have a tremendous drop to, say, $50,000. You got to go. You got to make some changes. What we do is prepare you for that drastic change. And with athletes, if I'm a professor, if I'm a doctor, a lawyer, well, let's say a professor, and I have a skill, I can go from one institution to another one and use that skill.
Exactly.
Okay. But if I'm a doctor or lawyer, I got to build my practice back up. Okay. But if I'm working for a large law firm and I decide for whatever reason to depart, then I got to be a sole practitioner. So now I got to build that up. So my point is this. If you are making $100,000, you're living in a $100,000 lifestyle, and you drop to 50. With the transition playbook, show you how to prepare yourself for when that happens, if they will listen. Athletes and entertainers typically, and I put me in that category, so I'm not pointing fingers except back at me. A lot of us don't listen until it's too late.
Yeah, and you can take that even past athletes and celebrities. I'll tell you, a lot of people in the business world, they're not paying attention. As long as the check's still rolling in, And all of a sudden, they're not networking. They're not net weaving. They're not going out and meeting people and talking to people. They're not treating with people with respect. And all of a sudden, when things change and the winds start blowing a little differently, and they're left out in the cold, then they come running back wanting to make sure that people can connect them. And it comes off a little differently than when you're building relationships.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because relationships is everything. The relationship we have with each other, the relationship we have with our father, the relationship we have with our employers and employees. Relationships is most important. There's a chapter we talk about how to build and maintain good relationships, how you can compliment others by complimenting yourself. And those people that you are associated with in your net weaving and networking will remain with you even when you're out of the game. And that game could be football, basketball, sports, lawyer, whatever it is. When you're out of the game, you have a different view of the world. And what we try to do is prepare you for that with different levels.
Relationships, as you mentioned, are very important. As a matter of fact, that's how I got a chance to meet you, through a relationship you have with Karen Robinson, co-founder, co-owner of Nanolumens. And we had her on our show several months ago, maybe a couple of months ago, and she introduced me to you. So what do you wish you knew about leadership much earlier in life?
I wish I had known one basic thing, what I did know. See, we don't know what we don't know. Like, for instance, 3 weeks ago, I didn't know I was going to be here sitting in front of you, but I am. When I was playing football, 3 weeks before I got hurt, I didn't know I was going to be hurt. So it's important to know what you don't know and to be able to take that and learn from it. Like, meeting you was a blessing to me because, first of all, I have three basic rules in my life, and it's real simple. I try to keep things simple. Three A's. A for approach. Well, the first one is actually appearance. Approach and attitude. When we met, I had the right, I hope, appearance.
Absolutely.
Tried to make the right approach. Say, hello, how you doing? My name is Joe Prophet. How are you? And I was smiling and thought, hey, man, how you doing? And I extend that hand out there. So if you didn't shake my hand, I said, I don't want to meet this guy anyway. you know what I mean?
I had to reciprocate.
I hear you.
Know I had mean? To reciprocate.
And then you were very professional and right off. And then the third A is attitude. Because I was prepared to say, well, even if he is rude and arrogant like most ball players, I know I'm just joking. If he's arrogant, so I can always just play it off and say, hey, man, you know, I'm sorry to feel that way. Maybe I made a mistake. But attitude is everything.
It is.
And like you say, man, it's all about meeting each other and being respectful of that situation. And not to pretend, because most folk, believe it or not, will accept you for what you are, not what you're trying to be. And sometimes it turned folks off. Like, some people say, like, well, you know what? Joe's a good old boy. Joe's all right. And or they say, well, I don't like him. Why? Because I don't like the way he combs his hair. That's why I don't have much hair left now, so it won't matter.
Yeah, you see? And it's not a problem for me either.
I got you.
So in your careers, and you've had many, as an author, a writer, and a student, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of the fact that I was able at an early age to make life better for my father and mom and my younger brothers and sisters, because where I grew up, everybody was about trying to help each other. It was really about family. And as I said earlier, it taught me the real meaning of teamwork. So if I'm proud of anything, my dad didn't live long enough to see me in the business. My mother did. Mm-hmm. My dad never did. He did see me play college football. He saw me integrate to school, and he saw me graduate in 4 years and do all the things there. But he never saw me as a professional athlete when all the things were done. He never saw Joe Prophet Day. But what he did see was a son that he raised, that his most proudest moment was when he was able to pick that 100 pounds of cotton that I thought made all the difference financially in my dad's life. Mm-hmm. So to me, everything I do is built on that foundation. That's why money doesn't excite me. It never did. God has always made it so I can make it. But I use that as a means to do the things I need to do.
Right.
But I understand the difference between what success really is. It depends on what field are you in at the time. Because if you're not a successful son or daughter, If you're not a successful father or husband, if you're not a successful friend or neighbor, then you're already out of the game. Mm. Because you have to become a person before you become a thing. And that's what I always try to relate back to. And if anybody ever listened to what I'm saying, I'm not trying to tell folks how. A lot of folks already achieved their success.
Right.
They've already arrived. And some are still trying on the road to get there. But for whatever position they're in, success is something that's earned, and you have an opportunity to do it again every day.
Very good. How would Dr. Joe Prophet like to be remembered? Now, you're not going anywhere yet. Now, we hope you're going to continue to live a long and successful and continued abundant life. But how would you like to be remembered from this day forward?
I'd like to be remembered as a team player, as a person that helped folks to make life better for themselves. you know, a lot of us think that, well, I did this and I did that. That's not important. I mean, where I come from, you don't talk about yourself and your achievements, because they call that bragging. And in Louisiana, the worst thing you can do is to be a bragger.
Especially if you don't deliver.
That's right. But even if you deliver, it's not proper
okay.
for
point.
A person to talk or toot their own horn. If I could do anything while I'm here, I'd like to be able to say I did a difference, made a difference in the lives of young people like people did with me. Because I remember growing up when people would tell me that I wouldn't amount to nothing because my dad was a sharecropper. And my dad would tell me, don't listen to those folks. They don't know what they're talking about. Say, you work real hard, and we're doing okay. And my dad would never take, see, back in those days, they had this government assistant like cheese and stuff like that. Daddy wouldn't take it. Hmm. And I said, Daddy, why won't you take it? He said, if I don't put it on the table, we're not going to eat it.
There you go.
So I learned how to be self-sufficient even when it hurts, because that pride build up, it helps your spirit. And if they can't break your spirit, they can't break you.
Great point. How important is it for employees, colleagues, and leadership to be lifelong learners?
It's the most important thing in the world. Even now, what we're trying to do, our specialty is kids, Youth United for Prosperity. But now we're starting to get these kids to go out and work with the elderly and get the elderly what we call digitized, get them into the medium, get them accustomed to getting beyond the fear of a computer so that they can have something to occupy their minds all day, and they don't have to get up and the big day of thing is strolling out. They can get on that computer, they can get online, and they won't be afraid to do it. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to accomplish in that area.
Excellent, excellent. So what are you doing to ensure you continue to grow and develop as a leader?
I try to work out 3 times a week. I try to eat right. And I try to share whatever information I have or instincts I have with others that are willing and ready to move forward to improve their lives, no matter what it is they want to improve. Mm-hmm. Try to help them to get there, because it all starts with the mentality of saying, if I can think it, I can do it.
I love it. Tell us a little bit about the ring on your finger. I know the people in radio land can't see it, but it's one of the first things I noticed when I met you, and I thought it was pretty interesting. So tell us a little bit about that. I know you got to be a little proud of that as well.
Yeah, I am. The ring, well, there's 2 rings. There's a championship ring on my right hand, and on the left hand is a wedding band. I assume you're talking about the right hand.
Well, both of them are important.
I got you. And both different fields, but both accomplishments I'm pretty proud of. But the football field, when we started back, when I came back from the injury with the Falcons, we had a, if you recall from Atlanta, we had a first time we had a 500 season. And we got to the playoffs, we got a ring after that. Mm-hmm. Then I went to the World Football League, actually much later. And we won the championship. It was the first time, and that was when Zonka from Miami and Warfield, the receiver, and we had George Meyer, quarterback. We had some great guys over there that from the NFL. They was really, really coming on. What happened to the league was that they was paying us so well, they were stealing everybody from the NFL.
That's right.
NFL sued them, et cetera. So then we got 2 rings. We got the championship ring. That night they came in and they took everything. So it took us a long time to get our rings.
Wow.
So, but championship rings, it's a symbol mm-hmm. of some of your accomplishments. And sometimes those rings, like to me, it means a lot. It's a conversation piece, but it's also like a constant reminder that you can continue to do things that are worthy of other folks' praise and notoriety.
So it's been a great pleasure, again, and an honor to have you on the show with me today, and I appreciate you for accepting our invitation. So here's my next to last question for you today. Which book has most impacted your leadership ability?
Well, that's a difficult question, but if I had to say one overall, it's A Way Out of No Way, Ambassador Andrew Young. The book talks about some of the same things that I encountered. You know, the ambassador is from Louisiana, mm-hmm. from New Orleans, and he talks about his grandmother in that book about how things could be so bad that you can only appeal to the Spirit. And the title of the book is A Way Out of No Way. And I remember my mother saying, more than my grandmother, that the Lord will make a way. And prayer changes things. And, you know, and back during the struggle, when we were trying to correct some problems we thought was wrong with this country, there were a lot of dark days. And those days, the light started to shine in various areas and pieces that help people to understand what is going on. So this book, A Way Out of No Way, has a lot of that in there. And I've read some others that are interesting, but that's the most interesting one.
Most impactful.
Next to the Bible, of course.
Okay.
And that.
Oh, very good. On behalf of our learning community, I'll tell you again that I truly appreciate you accepting the invitation to join us today. And I'd love to have you back on the show sometime if we can get our calendars all synced up. Would that work with you?
It'll be my pleasure.
Okay. With that in mind, could you tell us how our learning community can contact you by email, by phone, and or by phone?
I'm easy. The email is real simple, joeprofit.com. And that's P-R-O-F-I-T. That's my real family name. And my phone number is 800. Actually, it's toll-free, 866-663-2608. And if you want to call me direct, it's area code 678-269-7300.
Excellent. And with that response, we bring today's edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. We invite all our listeners to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. Also, please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu. I may need to get one of those shorter email addresses the way you got that set up. I love that.
Yes,
but at any rate, drop me an email at the long one, acm0996@kennesaw.edu, if you have recommendations for guests. For those of you interested in our award-winning executive MBA program, please go to the eMBA icon on our Global Leader Radio site to connect with us and sign up for an information session. So join us again at the same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with passionate people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.